Well, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 9 of the Memoirs of a Movie Stand-In podcast. I apologize for some of the background noise you may be hearing. The reason for that is that I'm commuting. I'm in the car, and it's only fitting that as I talk about Promised Land, I might as well be in the car, because I did spend a lot of time in the car running around all the different locations we used in the production of the Promised Land television show. And, well, basically all my stand-in work usually required a lot of driving to get to all the different locations. It was especially true with Promised Land because I think the producers and the writers, they sort of fell in love with the variety of all the scenery, all the different places you could go in the general Salt Lake City area within an hour's drive, let's say, of Salt Lake City. There's so many different things you could see. And so they ran us all over the place to see those places. Plus, of course, the Promised Land television show, the story, took place, you know, in various locations. These people were supposed to be traveling all over the country, seeing America and helping people out along the way, which, you know, Salt Lake City became a sort of a stand-in, and all of, you know, northern Utah, really, a stand-in for, you know, Pennsylvania and Arkansas and Colorado and New Mexico. You know, just it was a pretty good facsimile of a bunch of different places. So, all right, so here I am driving today, and I thought, well, maybe before I get into too much detail talking about episode 105 of the Promised Land show, which was the first of our Mooster episodes, before I get into that, maybe I'll talk some about, well, the different directors that we had on Promised Land and sort of how that worked. Now, when you're working on an episodic TV show, generally speaking, you're working with different directors every episode. Some directors, they'll come back, but that is one of the unique things about working in that environment. For me, it was a great learning experience because you got to have both the continuity of working with the same actors and the same crew members week in and week out, but then you also got the variety of working with different guest actors and different directors, you know, every week and a half or so. So that was neat, you know. It didn't always feel like, well, this is a brand new job and I have to get used to it every episode. But yet you were working for a different director every episode. And you got to learn, well, how do these people work? What is their style, and what are their concerns? And, you know, it's just a great learning experience. So the way it worked, let's see, those first few episodes we had, the pilot episode, directed by a gentleman named Michael Schultz, and then episode 101, directed by a gentleman by the name of Victor Lobel. Then the next episode, 102, was again Michael Schultz, and then 103 was again Victor Lobel. And then 104, we got a gentleman by the name of Gene Reynolds, followed once again by Victor Lobel. So it's quite a pattern here of Victor Lobel doing every other episode. All the odd-numbered episodes apparently looked like it was going to be Victor Lobel. And we liked Victor Lobel. There's no complaints there. But that pattern did not last. Now, you might say, well, if a guy like Victor wanted to direct so often, why didn't he just do every episode? Well, that's a good question, and I should explain how that works. You see, when an episode is in production, people are working on pre-production for the following episode. So they're going through the script, and they're, you know, kind of deciding how many locations we need to have, and what is the actual production schedule going to be. Are we going to, you know, do how many locations in one day, and, you know, how many sets do we need to build? All of these concerns are happening while one episode is being made, you know, for the following episode, they're doing all this preparation. And so the director of the following episode has to be involved in a lot of those decisions. Maybe even they're going to do some casting, maybe just some small parts that they need to cast locally, and they'll hold auditions. And so it's a very, very busy time. And then once an episode is finished, then the director will spend a day or two working with the editor to kind of wrap that part of the process up. And so anyway, because of that structure, it's really difficult for one director to handle, you know, like two episodes in a row, much less, you know, five episodes in a row. So that's why we sort of alternated there with Victor for a while. Now, I should tell you a little bit more about these gentlemen that we worked with. We had, Michael Schultz. And Michael Schultz had started to do a lot of different work with television programs. So, you know, he had directed episodes of Touched by an Angel and then Promised Land and other shows. You know, he would kind of go back to Hollywood and work on some things and then come out and work with us. And, you know, he had a pretty good variety of work that he was doing, but all, you know, basically television directing at that point. Earlier in his career, Michael Schultz had directed some feature films, and, you know, some more successful than others. A lot of people maybe remember a movie called Car Wash from the 70s, sort of this disco movie about these guys that worked at a car wash. And, you know, I actually did not see the movie Car Wash, of course, when it was brand new. I was pretty young back then. And I never saw it on video or TV or anything until just a couple of months ago. And that's a pretty interesting relic from the 1970s, just seeing all those cars and the different attitudes that reflected in the script there, those things that people felt were relevant to provide social commentary and comedy situations. Ah, boy. And then, interesting, that just sort of brief appearances in that movie from, George Carlin and Richard Pryor. Now, Michael Schultz had worked with Richard Pryor also on a movie called Greased Lightning. Greased Lightning was, I guess, the story of the first I don't know if this is really, you know, historically, I don't know. You know, this is based on a true story, I don't know. But the story, I believe, was kind of about the first African-American NASCAR racer to really be very successful. So you had Richard Pryor as this race car driver who, you know, wins, like, Talladega or something. I think it was Talladega. In a Ford Torino Cobra, which is pretty cool. I mean, I always liked the Torino, so that's pretty cool to me that Richard Pryor wins Talladega in a Torino Cobra. A movie called Grease Lightning. And let's see, other movies from Michael Schultz's career. One that people might remember, a movie from the late 70s starring the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton. Have you guessed it yet? Do you remember? Are you trivia fans out there? Well, I'm talking about a movie called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And this was, included a lot of Beatles songs. It's an unusual idea for a movie. But it is kind of interesting to hear all those Beatles songs remade by other people. Alice Cooper's in that movie, too. Alice Cooper gets beat up by the Bee Gees. You know, if you ever thought to yourself you had no interest in some silly movie starring the Bee Gees, it's an entertaining film. You might check it out, especially with some years of hindsight. It's kind of fun to see. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, directed by Michael Schultz. So, anyway, Yeah, so we got to work with Michael. Michael, great guy, just a very gentle director to work with, and we just always liked working with Michael Schultz. Then there was, okay, Victor. Victor had done a lot of television directing as well, and so he had done things like, even stuff like Star Trek. Voyager, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, stuff like that. So, you know, that may seem like a strange combination there for a director to bounce back and forth between Promised Land and Star Trek. But that's what Victor did, and, you know, a lot of other stuff in there. I should mention before I kind of move on from Michael Schultz that later on, Michael Schultz had directed episodes of, I think he worked on Joan of Arcadia. But I know that he worked on Everwood, which was not at all affiliated with Touched by an Angel or Promised Land, except that Everwood was actually shot in northern Utah. And so a lot of the people who had previous experience working on Promised Land and Touched by an Angel eventually wound up working on Everwood as well. But that's for later in my memoirs. Let's just jump back to 1996 again. Gene Reynolds was a director who worked with us a few times on Promised Land. The first episode he directed with us was The Prodigy, episode 104. And Gene Reynolds had, you know, just tons of previous experience working in television as a director and a producer, and was heavily involved in the MASH television series. So it's fun to have Gene around. Gene was, kind of a quiet guy, but, you know, again, all these guys, great to work with. We had, you know, we had a great time working with all of them. It was great to see just a different directing style with each of them. Gene, a very kind of unassuming, quiet man, but did great work, you know, and so I would have to say I didn't get to know Gene all that well, but what little I did know him, you know, perfectly wonderful gentleman that I enjoyed working with. Just a regular guy. Which sort of, to me, belied the, you know, what I expected maybe from this big-time television producer who had done MASH, you know, and here he was just this nice, you know, reserved guy. All right, so, and I should tell you a little bit about, again, the structure of how it works with these alternating directors and things. We did have on our production staff, of course, assistant directors. And for those of you who maybe read the credits of your favorite movies and TV shows and you wonder, well, who are all these assistant directors? Well, I'll tell you a little bit about that. As far as it works in television, you have a first assistant director, and then you have a second assistant director, and then you have a second assistant director. And then you have production assistants, and they're all sort of in the same department. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, this is ridiculous. Why so many assistant directors? And what in the world is a second assistant director? This is dumb. Well, what you know, they've got a guy who shines your shoes, and he's the second assistant director. Well, you know, you may think that if you don't know how it works on the film crew. I'll tell you right now, the second assistant director is a very, very important job. And those guys work their tails off. And so, you know, there's no getting away with making fun of the second assistant director. And it's really not even a dumb job title. Well, let's start with the first assistant director. This guy has a lot of, or woman, could be a woman, of course, has a lot of responsibility with kind of keeping us on schedule. This is the person who's usually kind of pushing hard to, you know, let's get this done. You know, we've got 20 minutes before lunch. How many shots can we get off before lunch? You know, and he's really pushing to keep that schedule because, in part because he's sort of responsible for making that schedule in the first place when they're doing the script breakdown and figuring out, you know, where things are going to happen and, you know, when things are actually going to be filmed. That first assistant director made that initial schedule and, you know, And it's very important to stay on schedule, of course, because it can cost money if you have to add an extra day to the production, or if you have to stay and work overtime in order to get things done. And, you know, of course, it's always a good idea to stay on schedule, especially on a TV series when, you know, you have another episode that you got to start shooting right after this one is done. So the first assistant director also, you know, this kind of surprised me at first to see this going on. This is the individual who actually calls for cameras to roll. It's a, you know, you may have thought watching, you know, behind the scenes stuff on movies, or maybe, especially if you watch a movie about people that are making a fictitious movie within a movie, you know, those kind of stories. I gotta tell you, if you want to know how movies are made, one of the worst ways to learn is to watch a movie within a movie kind of a story. Those are really actually very inaccurate, generally speaking, as far as how movies are made. So if it's a fictitious story and within the story someone's making a movie, and I can't think of an example right off the top of my head of a movie where that's the storyline, but I'll just tell you right up front, the ones I have seen, very, very inaccurate. I don't know why. You know, you'd think people who make movies would know how movies are made. So if they were making a movie in which there was this other fictitious movie being made, that you'd think they'd get it right. Well, you'd think so. And you'd be wrong. All right, so, okay, first assistant director. This is what surprised me. He's the guy that calls out, roll cameras. Of course, he waits until the director is ready for that and the actors are ready for that, but the guy who's actually calling it out, roll cameras, is the first assistant director. Then when cameras are rolling, it is the director who yells action and cut, but a lot of times it does seem like the first assistant director is taking charge of a lot of stuff, and maybe you got the idea that only the director was the guy who did that. In my experience, there's a pretty good division of labor here, and nobody really crosses anyone's lines very much, you know, in any way that would be disruptive. But basically, it's, you're talking about the director is in charge of the actors and their performances, and he's going to be working with the actors most closely out of anyone on the crew. The director may also have some specific things he would like to accomplish photographically. So the best directors are the guys who just talk with the director of photography, and they'd say, I like this kind of shot here, I'd like this kind of camera angle here, I'd like a close-up on this part. You know, they can just kind of give out their list there and then let the director of photography take it from there. I won't name names because honestly my mind has gone blank at the moment, but there are some directors who actually like to get up and look through the viewfinder of the camera, sit on the camera dolly, and that is actually rather annoying. And in my experience, directors who do that are not very good directors. The best directors are the ones who meddle as little as possible in what the other people are doing. So the best director does not kind of walk an actor through the paces and say, and then you stand here, and then you stand there, and then you say this line with this inflection, and you didn't. No, the best directors never do that. The best directors give as few instructions as possible and let the actors, who are there, you know, to contribute their own creativity, let the actors come up with their own performance, come up with their own movements, come up with their own inflections on how they're going to say a line. You know, that, of course, if the director really, really hates what they're doing, you know, he might, you know, give more specific directions on how to get it done. But generally speaking, a good director is one who is just very, very precise, very clear with his instructions, and then just gives the right amount of instructions to everyone else so that they can then bring their expertise to the table and you know, kind of flesh it out from there. So All right, so then the director of photography, he's in charge of how things look visually. So, you know, ultimately he's going to be the guy in charge of saying, well, this is where the camera is, and this is where the lights should be, and this is how many lights we should have. And so he really takes charge of all that stuff. And then the first assistant director, again, is just kind of being very practical about, let's keep on schedule, let's roll, let's cut, let's make sure the extras are where they need to be. You know, just a lot of work to do. So don't think that because there are so many assistant directors listed in the credits that they're all just sitting around, you know, making martinis for each other. No. It's all very, very hard work. They're very busy people, and they're on their feet and busy for like 12 hours a day. So a little bit of respect for these folks, please. All right. We had a first assistant director for every other episode and another first assistant director for, you know, the other episode. So that was another thing that we would alternate. Now, we would work with, you know, the same assistant director for every odd-numbered episode and the same assistant director for every even-numbered episode. Generally speaking, they would just alternate in that pattern. But everyone else on the crew would work on every episode. So the second assistant director, that's where we got some continuity between episodes. The second assistant director is, again, well, just mainly an assistant to the first assistant director. And working his tail off, his or her tail off. And our second assistant director on the Promised Land series was a very young man by the name of Anthony Hemingway. And, oh, man, what can I tell you about Anthony? This guy had the movie business, you know, in his DNA. And, in fact, his mother was, I think, a producer. Well, she had, you know, she had some positions of importance in the movie industry. So just kind of hanging out with his mother and being part of that family, Anthony just had some opportunities as a very young person to be around movie work and took to it like a fish taken to water, as they say. I guess at age about 14, he started working as production assistant and just being on movie sets and being useful and being very interested and very good at what he was doing on these movie sets. So by the time he was working with us as a second assistant director, and that's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty important job. You have to be a member of the Directors Guild and, you know, a lot of, you have to be experienced and really be competent and know what you're doing. He was 20 years old. He turned 21 during that fall of 1996, the beginning of our work on the Promised Land series. But yeah, Anthony was, he was sharp, he was on top of it, and he was young, and he was going places. And I, you know, I should have probably tried to be a better friend, you know, like, let's be best buds with Anthony, because he's going places, and I want to tag along for the ride. Well, I wasn't that way. I, of course, always enjoyed working with Anthony, but I, you know, we weren't like best buds, let's go hang out, and I'm going to ride your coattails. Not that kind of thing going on. But Anthony has done very, very well for himself. Anthony, he worked the first two seasons of Promised Land as a second assistant director. I think he would have loved to move up to be first assistant director, but didn't have a lot of opportunity there because our first assistant directors that we had on Promised Land were very happy with what they were doing, so they stayed there. And Anthony did eventually take an opportunity after two seasons of Promised Land to move on and work as a first assistant director elsewhere. And that's where I sort of lost track of Anthony Hemingway, but I must say he's done pretty well for himself ever since then, and now is a director who has done a lot of work in you know, episodic television, including stuff you've heard of, like CSI Miami and the new Battlestar Galactica series that's been on the Sci-Fi Channel and some things like that. So Anthony's still doing very well and still, you know, now, okay, now he's in his early 30s. Okay, fine, you know, he's still pretty young for a well-seasoned director. Another thing, I just have to say this about Anthony Hemingway, you know, because of the way our pay structure was working back then, when I was working as a stand-in, I had a pay voucher I had to fill out every day. And that's just, I don't know, that's just paperwork. But at the end of the day, I'd have to get one of the assistant directors to sign me out. And so sometimes it was Anthony. And he had the most beautiful handwriting. And it's such a long name, Anthony Hemingway. And he had the most beautiful signature. And I don't know if I still have any copies of my pay vouchers lying around with Anthony's wonderful signature on there. So that's kind of neat. Anthony Hemingway, I couldn't be happier for his success, and I wish him continued success. In fact, I just heard about him a couple months ago, a rumor, I don't know if this has been confirmed or not, that he's going to be directing a movie for George Lucas coming up, and it's... I want to say Tuskegee Airmen, that sort of story about, I think it was about the first, you know, African-American group of pilots. I'm not sure the whole history of that. But whatever it is, the rumor has it, and this is probably true, that Anthony is our man. He's going to be out there directing that feature film, which is it's pretty amazing, pretty impressive, and I couldn't be happier for Anthony Hemingway. All right, so that's some of my thoughts on the directors of Promised Land. And certainly there's more to say about the structure of the crew and how everyone comes together and how everyone works and how these jobs all complement each other. But maybe I'll get into that some other time. So I'll just call it for now. This has been... Episode 9 of the Memoirs of a Movie Stand-In podcast. Thanks for coming along on the ride for me here in my car. a long drive, but as I said, there were a lot of long drives as we were running all over the place making the Promised Land show. On the next episode, maybe I will finally talk about episode 105 of Promised Land, the Mooster episode, with special guest Cloris Leachman. And, yeah, we'll just save that till next time. Once again, my name is Greg Anderson. I am the movie stand-in, or at least I have been on many, many days of working on various film and television projects. And I love the movie business, and I love talking about it. And so I hope you at least have some enjoyment of listening to my stories. If you want to look at the official show notes of the Memoirs of a Movie Stand-In podcast, you will find them at utahstandin.blogspot.com. That's utahstandin.blogspot.com. And my email address, if you have any feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, if you are Anthony Hemingway and you want to get back in touch with me, do any favors for me, my email address is moviestandin@gmail.com. No special, hyphens or spaces or punctuation of any sort there. Just moviestandin@gmail.com. And, let's stay in touch. So, that's the episode for now. Hope you'll join me next time. Thursday nights at 8, 7 Central Time. That's when you can watch for new episodes of the Memoirs of a Movie Stand-In podcast. If you were to subscribe in iTunes or some other podcatching software, those things just come up automatically when the feed is updated. So I hope you'll join me next time for episode 10 of the Memoirs of a Movie Stand-In podcast.